is the third lecture of Adventures in Energy Economics for the Mises Academy class. We originally were doing this on a few days ago, and now this is the makeup session. So welcome. And what we're going to do is, as this menu suggests, we're going to review the material from Rothbard, because this was supposed to have been in week two, and we just ran out of time. And then a quick overview of free market environmentalism, and then we're going to get into the first part of the economics of climate change. And I just want to stress that in tonight's lecture, I'm just going to give you an overview of the economics of climate change from a mainstream perspective. So I just want you to be familiar with the vocabulary and the way that a mainstream economist talks about this stuff. And then next week, which is week four of this class, we'll do part two of the economics of climate change, where I'll explain to you various pitfalls and the standard treatment from an Austrian perspective. Okay, so first of all, the Rothbardian view. This is from this classic article on property rights and the legal structure and then how it's applied to pollution. So let me just step back and make sure you get the big picture. If you read the article, you might have been surprised that Rothbard, in the beginning, it doesn't seem like it's an article about environmental issues at all. It seems like he's writing an article on legal theory. And that's not by mistake, and it's not that Rothbard just sort of got off on a tangent. He's doing that quite consciously, because if you think about it, that's the standard approach that Rothbard takes in general to these sorts of issues. So it's, typically when Rothbard tries to think about what's the treatment of something, he reduces it to property rights. And so if the issue is, hey, should blackmail be a crime, or what about immunity for police officers, that sort of thing, these real subtle questions. What about screaming fire in a crowded theater? Should that be a crime or not? All these types of issues that in our modern treatment in terms of people writing op-eds and Alan Dershowitz weighing in and the pundits and the legal theorists and the Supreme Court in today's world, where there's these sort of manufactured debates, and the way a Rothbardian typically deals with these things is just to say, no, it's not weighing this person's interest against this interest. And yes, there's a matter of national security, but then does that trump privacy rights? And you get all these weird things, and like a flag burning, or should kids be allowed to pray in public schools? And should you be able to tell a homeless person to leave a public library, and all these issues that are really hard to solve when you have the government in there and these mixed up intuitions and various competing things that tug at your heartstrings. And the way a Rothbardian typically deals with all that is to say, no, just let's think through calmly what the property rights are in this given situation, and then the answer pops out. So that's what he's doing here. That instead of wringing our hands over, oh my gosh, we don't want to destroy the environment, but at the same time we don't want to cripple economic growth, and we want to create jobs, but we also want to save endangered species, and it's all these things, and it's no, don't worry about any of that stuff. Don't try to force the answer that you think ought to be the answer. Just calmly think through the basic correct framework of property rights in a free society, and then you'll see when you apply it to environmental issues like air pollution or dumping chemicals in the river or whatever it is, that usually what happens is the thing that's the correct thing to do based on just property rights and the application of the law in a disinterested fashion, that more often than not promotes the pragmatic outcome that the proponent of government intervention was hoping for in the first place, right? So that there really isn't this dichotomy between what is just and what is pragmatic, or there's no trade-off between fairness and efficiency the way that you often think there is listening to a mainstream orthodox analysis. Okay, so again, that's what he's doing in this article. He's just walking through some of the subtleties in libertarian legal theory, so that when he turns his attention to air pollution and things like that, the answer just pops out. Okay, so some of his general principles talking about the law from a Rothbardian perspective, but obviously Rothbard doesn't call it that, that would be immodest. He's saying, look, it should be, the treatment is normative, not positive. And so what those terms mean in this context, normative means you are bringing in your value judgments, not that you're just smuggling in your arbitrary wins, but he's saying it's not, you know, it's not this fiction of a positive analysis, which is like what the Coasean theorist would do. Okay, so to give you an example of what I mean in this dichotomy, just to take the simplistic example that Walter Block might use, is to say, look, if we're trying to figure out, you know, who in a free society, who should be given the property title to this wallet right here, you know, holding up a wallet, and a Rothbardian Walter Block and the man on the street is going to say, well, you know, whose wallet is it? Like, who earned the money in there? That sort of thing. And that's the way we would figure out who owns it. Whereas, strictly speaking, Ronald Coase and the people who follow in the Chicago law and economics tradition, if they actually believed their own official view, and maybe some of them deep down don't really believe it in their heart, maybe they just publish that stuff because it's, you know, it sounds so interesting and so forth. But he was saying, strictly speaking, if you took this stuff at face value, the way the judge ought to determine who is the owner of that wallet is to say, how would it maximize efficiency in society if we assign the property right to one person versus another? So it may happen to be that the correct thing to do is to say the owner of that wallet is the person who went out and worked and earned the money that's in it and so forth, and or who bought the wallet with voluntary transactions. But it very well could be this guy over here who stole it from someone. I mean smuggling in, so I should say. It could be this guy over here who broke a window, climbed into your house, grabbed the wallet, and left. So I'm not using the verb stole because that smuggles in property rights language, right? So, you know, whereas to Walter Block and other people, that's obviously not the right person to give ownership to. In a Coasean world, you can't just assume that a priori. You have to deduce that based on utilitarian cost-benefit analysis. Okay, so that's what Rothbard's getting at when he says the proper delineation of property titles is necessarily normative, that you are, in a sense, making value judgments, not in the sense of like saying, oh, I like chocolate more than vanilla, but in the sense of saying that, no, when you're writing about what the law ought to be, that's a normative enterprise. You can't just remain agnostic and say, well, who am I to impose my value judgments? That's what you're doing. You're talking about what justice is. Okay. Another important principle, Rothbard says, is that if we're going to be talking about violations of property rights, there necessarily has to be a physical invasion involved. It's not enough just to show that one person harmed, in some generic sense, another person. And so, just to be crystal clear, the physical invasion is necessary but not sufficient. Okay? So why is it necessary? Well, look, let me just give you some examples as to why there could be harm without physical invasion. So if I open up a restaurant that competes with the restaurant down the street, and in a sense I'm stealing customers, but I'm not actually violating, you know, I'm not physically doing anything to the property of the other competing restaurant owner, well, I'm not in any way engaging in aggression against him, even though there's a real sense in which I'm harming him. I mean, the restaurant owner down the street might have preferred that I go up and take a baseball bat and smash all of his windows rather than I open up a competing restaurant, because in the long run, I might put him out of business with my tough competition, whereas if I smash all his windows, you know, he just has to keep the place closed for a day or two and get him replaced, and that's it. Then he can move on. Okay, so that's, or, you know, other examples, the blackmailer, you know, someone who has really juicy gossip about somebody, if he goes out and gives that information to the newspaper reporter and they write the report, I mean, that might ruin somebody's career. It might cause a guy's wife to divorce, actually, depending on what the story is. And so there's an obvious everyday sense in which the person who gossiped harmed the other person, but Roth is saying there's no physical invasion. So that's the, so if we're talking about something that you could use the force of law to stop, the thing you're stopping has to involve a physical invasion. Someone doing something to you that does not in any way involve a physical invasion, then that person is not violating your property rights, and it would be immoral for you to try to use force to stop the person from acting like that. So if I try to use force to stop someone from opening a restaurant that competes with my restaurant, I'm the lawbreaker, even though that person is demonstrably harming me. Okay. Another principle is strict liability as opposed to the reasonable person standard. So here, we got a lot of material tonight, so I'm going to be quick with this. So also with this stuff, I mean, Rothbard's such a clear writer that I'm just hitting some of the key points I want to make sure you get. I'm assuming if you go and read Rothbard that you'll get it. So I'm not trying to substitute for reading the material. I really encourage you. It's a great essay to go read it if you haven't already. But make sure you get this point. He is advocating for what's called strict liability. So in mainstream, you know, the actual real world law, sometimes, you know, there is such a thing as a strict liability standard, but it's not often invoked, or it's not often the one that the judge will say is relevant in a given case. And so something, you know, a different type of standard is the reasonable person standard. So let me just try to give you an extreme example just so you can understand. A lot of times it's tricky. Let me just off the top of my head, let me just give you something to show you the kind of distinction. So if you walked into a restaurant and that you went to sit down and they came up and they put the plate on your table and then you get a phone call that you're like, whoa, whoa. And like, you find out that, you know, your wife just had, is going to have triplets or something. And you say, wow. And you stand up really fast and you flip the table over and you break all the dishes. You know, it's conceivable that you would be, that the restaurant owner could sue you under strict liability, you know, and, because, you know, you certainly, you know, there was no contract that said, oh, since I'm a customer, I can break stuff, right? And then even more, you know, less obvious would be just normal. You're sitting there and you just slip and you drop the glass and the breaks on the floor. You know, it's not obvious what the legal ruling is there. And so I think, you know, under strict liability, people will know you're responsible for that. Now, I think the reason these things get tricky is that in practice, a restaurant is not going to prosecute you for breaking a glass at dinner because that's just bad for business, and that doesn't seem reasonable. You know what I mean? So that's why I'm saying it's hard to really – how can I put it? It's not that these crazy draconian things would actually happen in practice in a free market society where the judges followed Rothbardian principles, because, in other words, where strict liability is going to differ from the reasonable person standard necessarily is in cases where strict liability seems to be saying something is going to occur that's not reasonable. You get what I'm saying? So it's almost like designed to sound crazy, but the point is, You're not off the hook. If you genuinely cause damage to somebody, even if what you were doing was something that any reasonable person might have done, you're not off the hook, right? It's you know, you could say, well, I'm trying to, like, if you're walking down the street and there's a guy painting his house and he's on a ladder, maybe this is a better example. A guy's painting his house, he's on a ladder and he's, you know, up, or he's changing the second story window in his house, right? So he's in his front lawn, there's a ladder, it's his property, and you're walking down the street and, you know, somebody's dog comes out and starts barking at you and scares you, and you, whoa, and you, go, and you hit the ladder, and the ladder thing, and the guy falls and breaks his arm, and he got a huge hospital bill. The point is, somebody is liable for that guy falling off the ladder. Now, it's not clear if it's you or if it's the owner of the dog, but the point is that guy gets to sue somebody, right? It would not be fine for you to just say, well, come on, how can I be at fault? I was just walking down the street and this guy's dog scared me. Any reasonable person would have backed up. And it's not fine for the dog owner to just say, well, I mean, that's, you know, my dog didn't actually even bite anybody. Are you kidding me? Just because my dog started barking at somebody, now I'm responsible for the guy who broke his arm. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm just trying to come up with some examples where it could be, using a reasonable person standard, the guy who fell off the ladder, it's just dumb luck and he's got to pay the bill, when somebody clearly did something to him. And I'm saying, under strict liability, you can, even if you ended up causing significant damages to somebody through a physical invasion, even though anybody could look at what happened and realize you're not a bad guy, and that, you know, if they had been in your position, they probably would have done the same thing, that's not enough to exonerate you. It's just like, well, geez, that was a quirky thing and that sucks, but you know what? There's strict liability, so yeah, you're the one who now has to pay the big hospital bills, even though that could have happened to any of us. All right, so that's what strict liability is. And the reason, I mean, that goes along with Rothbard saying, no, property rights are really important, and if you violate somebody's property rights, you have to make up for it, regardless of whether, you know, your intentions and whether you really meant well, and oh my gosh, and you feel awful, that's not really the issue. Okay, now applied to pollution, let me just quickly go over three things. Rothbard stresses that the actual victims of the pollution have to bring suit, as opposed to like the district attorney. Okay, so Rothbard's saying, let me also just clarify, don't buy into the stereotype that libertarians or Rothbardians in particular are pro-business and anti-environment. That's not true. And that's a very convenient dichotomy that typically leftists try to encourage, but also with some justification, because there's people who are on the right, and I speak in terms of modern American political discourse. I don't know if you're European and you're watching this, I don't know if my discussion will sound correct to you, because I don't know what how the divide is in Europe, but certainly in the United States, there is this stereotype that has some validity to it, that people who call themselves right-wingers or conservatives don't really get worked up about protecting the environment. And they don't really care if some species goes extinct, that what they care about is job creation. They care about rising GDP and, you know, boosting employment, whereas the people who are typically considered left-wingers or, you know, liberal environmentalists, they're the ones who don't care so much about imposing high costs on business, and they don't care about raising prices by putting in regulations that are inefficient. They're more concerned about protecting old growth forests, and they're more concerned about protecting slugs and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I'm saying that is not really an accurate dichotomy as far as libertarianism is concerned. Because if you believe in the protection of property rights, well, that includes the environment. And this kind of goes back to what I was saying, is that the way Rothbard and Rothbardians typically deal with social problems and these apparent conflicts between, you know, oh, civil liberties, but the need for protection, you know, security, you know, oh, should people be able to tell me to take off my shoes when I try to fly in the airplane? And it seems like there's this dichotomy between security and civil liberty, or, you know, should industry be able to put pollution into the atmosphere? And it seems like there's this trade-off between air quality versus economic output. And the point is that no, there are none of these dichotomies. The issue is just specify what the property rights are and then let people in a market exchange them voluntarily, and all of these competing interests will get accounted for in market prices. And, you know, if you're in a world where people would rather have more television sets and cars rather than cleaner air, well, market forces will lead to that outcome. Whereas if you're in a different kind of world where people are wealthy enough that they're willing to spend a little bit more per unit of electricity or whatever in order to have very clean air, well, then that's what the market outcome would deliver. Okay, so that's kind of the general free market environmentalist approach. So anyway, back to this particular slide, Rothbard is saying it's entirely possible that in a libertarian legal framework, somebody would be, you know, some business, for example, would be breaking the law by dumping chemicals into the river or pumping particles into the atmosphere. And he's saying, but it's not that some third party is just going to stumble on the scene and say, hey, you're an environmental criminal, I'm going to sue you. He said, rather, it would have to be the people who are demonstrably being injured by a physical invasion, that you would have to make a connection between the smokestacks pumping stuff into the atmosphere and then, you know, somebody's lungs being that interacting directly and physically in some way with somebody. And then those people who are being harmed can then be the ones to bring suit. Now, don't misunderstand, they can transfer that claim to somebody else. All right, so you're allowed to transfer your rightful claim on some aggressor, but the point is that it has to originate with the actual victim. Okay, another principle he mentions is this term privity, and he brings it up in the context of automobiles. So here, what the term means, it's kind of related to strict liability in a sense. It's saying if you're going to crack down on somebody for a crime, it has to be the person actually doing it. It can't be somebody who's merely enabling it. And so in the automobile example, he's saying, you know, what happens in the world today is that, for example, the government will say, automobiles, if they are designed a certain way and people are driving them, they pump certain pollutants into the atmosphere, and that hurts everybody in the city. You know, it causes smog, so people with asthma have difficulty breathing, and just even for people with, you know, not perfectly healthy lungs and so forth, it can cause more cancer or whatever the particular objection is. So Rothbard is saying, you know, if that is indeed the case, the answer is not to do what the government does and go to the automobile manufacturers and start slapping on huge regulations on them and fining them if they produce cars that don't, you know, have clean burning engines and things like that. He said, because it's not the automobile manufacturer that's actually pumping the stuff into the atmosphere. It's the people who buy the car and then are putting gasoline in it and driving around. They're the ones who own these machines that, by stipulation, are causing harm to other people. So that's just another example, just to kind of show you how it is conceivable that a libertarian legal system would have sanctions on activity that right now government penalizes in the name of protecting the environment. But Rothbard just going through and showing how the methods that the libertarian legal system would use are not the same as what the government would do. So it's not like there would be an EPA that would just be voluntary and private that would then go along and say to automobile companies, okay, you got to produce cars that have these, you know, this many miles per gallon, and it has to have this kind of thing, like it has to, you know, filter out sulfur and not pump this much stuff in the atmosphere. It's got to be so-and-so parts per million, blah, blah, blah. The way that the EPA right now imposes on automobile manufacturers. Rothbard saying that's not the way it would work, because if you think about it, even on its own terms, somebody producing an automobile, that's not the crime unless it's literally the physical production process, like the factory that makes the automobiles. If that factory is pumping stuff in the atmosphere, then maybe somebody could bring suit. But it's not the production per se. So just like with guns, it's certainly a crime in a Rothbardian world if somebody takes a handgun and goes and shoots an innocent person with it. And that, you know, the victim or the victim's family or whatever can go after the murderer, but you can't just go after somebody who makes guns because they might be used in a criminal fashion. So by the same token, just because someone's making cars that somebody might take and then put gasoline and drive around and pollute the atmosphere, that's, it shouldn't be a crime to make cars that way. All right, so that's what Rothbard's getting at. Okay, last principle, and I'll be really quick because we got a lot of material tonight. He's saying, look, utilitarian considerations can't trump justice. So this goes back to the Bloch's problem with the Ronald Coase Chicago law and economics approach. But applied to pollution and just environmental issues in general, Rothbard is saying the when you want to solve a particular issue, you don't ask yourself, well, what's going to promote the most utility or what's going to generate the most, the highest monetary return all parties considered or something like that. You have to ask, what are the property rights? And then the correct thing to do is to say, if somebody's violating someone else's property rights, they need to stop doing that. Or at the very least, they have to compensate the person. You know, if it can be demonstrated that they violated someone's property rights, and the judge rules, okay, well, you owe damages then. So you wouldn't say, oh, well, yeah, technically the household living downstream from the factory should be able to, you know, have the legal right to have an injunction to keep the factory from dumping chemicals in the river. But come on, if we were to actually allow a household to do that, then how could we have the Industrial Revolution? So we're going to take away that right. So that's what actually happened historically. In the common law, the principles that developed, in that era, people would have had the ability, once technological changes occurred and certain factories were in fact, you know, sending out soot into the air so that households downwind, if they were putting out their laundry to dry in the backyard, they would go out and look, and the clothes would be all dirty because of all the, you know, dirt in the air, whatever the factory was pumping out of its smokestack in the air. And so under common law principles, they should have been able to go to the judge and say, whoa, that factory needs to stop. And the point is, apparently a lot of judges, like in the late 1800s, early 1900s, throughout those cases and just said, no, you know, as long as it's not too unreasonable, factories can be allowed to do that. And their rationale was they thought they needed to foster economic growth. So, and anyway, like I say, Rothbard was saying, no, the way you'd solve that is to just say, what is the property rights in this situation? Okay, free market environmentalism is not an oxymoron. So this is something that Walter Bloch in particular has written extensively on. And again, just the big picture is, don't get sucked into this standard dichotomy that you often see, at least in the American political scene, where on the one hand it's, cheap energy prices and job creation and economic growth, and who cares about the environment? And on the other hand, it's protecting the spotted owl and so forth, and we don't care about such dirty things as money. Well, that's beneath us to worry about money. That's not the libertarian approach. The libertarian approach is to say, no, what are the property rights? And if people really do think that protecting this particular forest is more important than having another shopping mall, well, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that value judgment. And if you have private property rights, that's what will happen. you know, people will be able to donate enough money to some philanthropic organization and they'll buy the land and that's it. But on the other hand, if people really are willing to spend a lot on the products that a shopping mall would have there, such that the developer comes in and can bid more for that land than the philanthropic organization can raise in donations, well then the developer is going to outbid it, and so the market's going to allocate that real estate to the shopping mall. Okay, let me just go over some basic stuff. Many of you probably heard this kind of thing, but I just want to make sure, in case you haven't heard it, that I don't skip it. So what is it about endangered species versus ones that there's no problem? So, you know, you've got some famous ones, the bald eagle, white rhino, humpback whale. At various times in my life, each of these was the hot button endangered species, of the day, or, you know, of the few years. And there was a big campaign to raise awareness and big penalties and social stigma attached to what kind of monster would traffic in the, you know, horns of the white rhino and that kind of thing. There was even one of the Star Trek movies was they had to go back in time to get a humpback whale because man had foolishly, you know, driven them into extinction, that kind of thing. All right. Whereas, you know, chickens and cattle, we don't have to worry about them going extinct. It's not that there has to be public awareness in order to not slaughter too many chickens and to make sure that they get preserved. Even though you think about it, I mean, it's not like people are out serving bald eagle burgers. And so isn't that odd that, you know, these creatures that you would probably think would be the most likely to be wiped out by humankind are actually the ones that are all over the place. But the ones that, you know, I guess the white rhino, you could say there was a, you know, people wanted the horn, but, you know, the other ones, it's odd. And so in addition to the difference of one group of animals has been endangered and the other one wasn't, another major difference is the former category are not typically owned, whereas the latter, it's, you know, commonplace for people to be able to own that. And so that's, you know, so the free market environmentalist says that's the fundamental reason, that when you are allowed to own a resource, you have an interest in preserving it. Whereas the humpback whale lived in the ocean, which was technically owned by government or owned by nobody. If it's an international waters, and it's not really clear what the rules are. And so nobody can say, you know, it's not like so various proposals to protect the humpback whale and so forth would be privatizing the oceans. And there's issues about, well, how would you do that? Would you, you know, would you just like sell off certain volumes of ocean water, you know, specify what the coordinates were and the depth and so forth, and like in a sense sell these humongous cubes of ocean water to various owners, and then anything that's in the cube is yours? Or would you sell the actual humpback whale and then tag it so that no matter where it swam, hey, that's my whale? And it's not obvious how you'd solve problems like that, but it's analogous to, you know, back when there were cattle and horses on the open range, and then the issue was, you know, did you own those horses and the animals? And it's, you know, did you have to fence it off? And what happened if your animal strayed onto somebody else's land? So, I mean, there were some issues like that as well back in the days of the cowboys. But the point is, despite these sort of quirky issues of implementation, clearly the solution is, from a free market environmentalist perspective, property rights. And that the fundamental problem with endangered species is that either nobody owns it at all, or the government technically owns it, which is basically the same thing as saying nobody owns it, because the government is typically just controlled by a clique of people who are in power for a little while, so they're very short-sighted. So let me just give you a quick example when it comes to like protecting the forest. And you hear about things like, oh, just cutting down the trees and logging in a very destructive, environmentally harmful fashion. And, you know, in a typical environmentalist, we get all worked up about these evil private companies that just come in and just slash the trees down and they don't replant them very, you know, in other words, they cut down the trees in order to make paper pulp and whatever, and they kind of destroy the land, whereas there would be different techniques. You would do it in a way that was a little bit more expensive, but that would preserve the land so that the, you know, you'd replant and whatever, so that you preserve the forest going into the future to be handed down to our children and grandchildren, as opposed to just kind of, you know, raping the land. And the point is, the reason that happens is that the private companies don't buy the land outright. The government just leases the logging rights. The government doesn't actually privatize the forest and sell off ownership rights to the company to then say, okay, you own this land and you can do whatever you want with the trees now. No, instead, the government just, for a certain amount of money, says you have the right to bring your logging equipment onto our land, the national forest or whatever it is, and then as much lumber as you can drag off in the next 3 weeks, go ahead. And so given that incentive structure, of course, the private company is just going to try to maximize and cut down as much as possible and not care about preserving the capital value of that asset 50 years from now, because they don't get to retain it 50 years from now. Okay, so what the buzz phrase in this area is called tragedy of the commons, and it's often associated with logging, but I think the more common treatment is overfishing, and the classic example was overgrazing. So the idea was that in England, before the enclosure movement, when people just had their herds, you know, just going around eating the grass, that they would overgraze, right? So the herds would eat, the people running the herds would allow their animals to eat more of the grass than they should have in terms of maintaining the ability of the land to support the herds. And the problem was, and this guy Garrett Hardin was the one who really had the classic analysis of this. The problem was, I don't know that he actually put it in these words, the problem was that there were no, the incentives were messed up. That if you, you know, your animals are eating the grass and you realize it's at the point where, you know what, we ought to not eat so much and let the grass rejuvenate itself. And I should move the herd somewhere else and let this particular land now recuperate. Well, there wasn't the incentive to do that, because then somebody else with his herd could just come in and have his animals eat that grass. Okay, and so the way this problem was eventually solved was when they built barbed wire fences and they had the enclosure movement, and so that land got divvied up to owners. And so it was no longer this public resource of just a bunch of pasture land that anybody with a herd could drive their herd into and eat. But now you have private property rights, and now, you know, the rancher on his own land is not going to stupidly have his animals eat so much that it destroys the ability of the pasture land to recover and to provide a flow of services of feeding the animals indefinitely into the future. Okay, so let me just make sure you're getting this. I mean, if think of it as you're a farmer and you have a bunch of pigs, and they naturally reproduce, right? So you're not going to, it doesn't matter if the price of pork goes way up, you're not going to just slaughter all your pigs and bring them to market that year to get a bunch of money and then be like, oops, now I don't have any more pigs. Or, I mean, if you did do that, it would only be because you know you could buy more next year from somebody else. But if you had the only pigs in the world and you just had them sitting there, you would not slaughter all your last pigs. You would always make sure you had enough to reproduce, to keep some, you know, to keep it alive. Or another analogy you wouldn't, if you're planting corn, you would always save the seed corn. You wouldn't sell off or eat the seed corn. You would retain it to be able to plant so you could have corn again next year and keep the cycle going. So, but the reason for that is that you get to reap the fruits of your labors, that you get to reap the future benefits of you acting responsibly today. But without property rights, if anybody could come into your land and take the corn next year, well, then you might eat the seed corn, or you'd have more of an incentive to eat the seed corn today than otherwise. And the same thing with overfishing, that one of the common problems is that, you know, you could have like a body of water, like a big lake, and the government owns it, and the government realizes, oh, wait a minute, you know, if we had no rules, if we had laissez-faire, people would keep buying ever more sophisticated fishing equipment. They'd have bigger and faster boats, they would have bigger nets, and they would go out and just fish and get all the trout, it wouldn't be trout, but, you know, get all the whatever the fish are in this lake, and then after a while there'd be no more fish because they would even capture the little babies or whatever, and so they would destroy the population, and then after like a few big catches, boom, the pond would be, or the lake would forever be devoid of fish because these idiots couldn't think long term. And so that's why we need the government to impose limits like fishing seasons and size restrictions. So if you catch fish and they're too little, you got to throw them back. Okay. And so that's the mentality. And they even have really, really inefficient rules like limiting the size of the boats and saying you can't use nets that are bigger than a certain size. So it's like passing rules to make fishing less efficient, to cripple the ability of the fishermen and women to go out and with a small amount of labor to be able to catch as many fish as possible, because they don't want them to have the ability to drive the population of the fish below their natural sustainable level. So instead of doing that, instead, what if you privatized it? And then the owner would have a much better incentive to do an economically responsible thing, which is not to cripple the efficiency of the customers, but just to charge an appropriate price to say, you know, to say, well, yeah, you can come and fish, but then you're going to pay me for every pound of fish you bring out or whatever. Instead, it's such that the fishermen and women would not want to fish more than the optimal amount in terms of not destroying the natural populations. All right. So why doesn't the government do that? How come the government imposes all these crazy restrictions instead of doing the, you know, efficient types of restrictions? Well, because they don't have any interest in it, right? The guy who's in charge of the parks and the forest and whatever, he can't, if he changes the incentive structure, he can't pocket the money because that would be considered stealing government funds. He'd go to jail for doing that. Whereas the private owner of the lake, of course, pockets the money if he comes up with a set of rules that not only preserves the fish population, but also increases how much profit he makes from owning it. All right, so that's just this example. One last thing before we move on, though. This guy, Garrett Hardin, he was not a free market economist. But he's the one who coined this term, tragedy of the commons. I think he coined the term. He was certainly the one that popularized it. So if you start reading in this literature, if you Google tragedy of the commons and want to read more about it, you're going to bump into this guy, Garrett Hardin. But he, I believe, was an ecologist. Okay, so, he isolated the problem and the way he framed it is, oh, sometimes individuals acting in their own self-interest don't promote the general interest. And that's why you got to have the right incentive structure. But I don't think, you know, his general answer was, and therefore we need private property rights. That's not at all where he's coming from. I'm just saying free market economists seized upon this, and you will often see people referring to the tragedy of the commons to show the danger of government ownership, because that's de facto no ownership, since the government typically doesn't act the way a responsible private owner would. Okay, so now in the remaining time, so we go till 45 after. I got that right? And then we'll turn over to Q&A. Let's talk about the economics of climate change. And again, in case you tuned in late, let me just reiterate. What I'm going to give you for the remainder of this lecture is the mainstream view. So if I'm talking and you're becoming horrified, like you can't believe, because I'm just going to go over, this is the way, if you took, environmental analysis taught by an economist at Harvard, an undergrad level or something, the kind of stuff I'm going to give you is that, just so you understand the framework. And then next week we'll walk through some of the problems with it. Okay, so you guys all know who that is. That's Krugman. This is Greg Mankiw, who's very big on a carbon tax. And this is William Nordhaus, who is one of the pioneers in the economics of climate change literature. He's also the author of what's called the DICE model, which is actually one of the models used by the U.S. government to calculate what's called the social cost of carbon. So if you want to, if you're going to impose cap and trade or a carbon tax, to calibrate it, to come up with the actual number to say, well, how high of a tax should we set, you would use a model like the one developed by William Nordhaus. Okay, so these guys are all, and Krugman too, he's not actually in this field per se. It's not like Krugman has published peer-reviewed papers on climate change, but in his perch at the New York Times, he has dabbled in this stuff. And say what you will about Krugman, he can dive into an area and absorb a lot of it pretty fast. And, you know, he always knows, he always has enough information to be dangerous. And so he's written a lot on the economics of climate change in, you know, in his blog or op-ed position, not as published peer review stuff. And so anyway, that's why I'm saying that the kind of perspective he brings to it is what I'm going to go over in the next 25 minutes. Okay, so let me just give you some context here, because when you dive into this stuff, people are going to throw around terms, and I kind of want to make sure if you've never really looked at it, you understand what's going on. So people will often refer to the IPCC, and that is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So when this started getting really to be a hot topic, the major governments of the world all got together and established this panel. And so they picked a bunch of experts in the various fields, and then their job was to go out and summarize the literature, you know, so to provide a consensus, definitive, authoritative document, a reference point for policymakers. And so this is what people, you know, might refer to when they talk about the consensus. So you'll hear this phrase all the time that, because what happens is the rhetorical strategy of people who want government to intervene more heavily in energy markets in the name of combating climate change, not just energy markets, but transportation markets, everything really. I mean, depending on how zealous the person is. I mean, food markets, what have you, agricultural markets. The rhetorical strategy is to say, look at, you know, 98%, and this is what Barbara Boxer just said to me 2 days ago, or was it might have even been yesterday, I'm getting mixed up. Yeah, it was yesterday, saying 98% of the scientists all say one thing, and then you guys are saying the right, you know, to make it look like anybody who disagrees with this is either a nut job or must be a shill for certain special interests. But anyway, so what the IPCC is this thing where they take certain academics from various fields. So it's the physical science, meaning the people who are just studying carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions, and how does that alter the climate system? So it's not, you know, in terms of temperature increase, but also ocean acidification, sea level rise, you know, all the various effects. So that's all a physical issue, right? That involves physics and chemistry and things like that. That's not economic. But then, of course, there's also economics involved. They bring in economists as well. So you need experts in various disciplines. And so the IPCC reports, and they're big. Actually, let me show you. Okay, so this let me look at my camera here to make sure I'm showing you guys. All right, so this is the fourth one. You can see it says the physical science basis, meaning, so you can see how thick this thing is. So just this is summarizing the physical science of climate change. And then this, it's the same year, but this is talking about mitigation of climate change. And again, it's this humongous, really thick book. And so the mitigation is saying, okay, given now that the physical science has been established and shows us, you know, given a certain trajectory of emissions and concentration of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, how will the climate system respond to that? Well, now the mitigation strategies are saying, you know, what sorts of things could we do to try to mitigate that outcome? So strategies that humans could employ to try to arrest those trends. If you think, you know, those are actually technically different things, even though they're related. You need to know what the physical science basis is to then even start talking about what could we do to try to, you know, so you might study things like, well, what if we just banned coal-fired power plants? What effect would that have? And so once you start talking about strategy to mitigate it, then you necessarily need economists to get involved, because they have to analyze the, you know, in other words, government policies involve human beings. You can't just go from a government policy to the impact on the climate system, because you need to know, well, how will those policies make humans act differently? And that's necessarily an economic question. Okay, so just to give you some of the jargon, the ones I was just holding, that was called the AR4. So people would refer to it and say, oh, the IPCC AR4 said blah, blah, blah. And AR4 stands for Fourth Assessment Report. So that was the fourth IPCC report in the series. So they come out every few years. And that was the fourth one. All right, so then, okay. And you'll see charts like this. And so these things, you don't need, I'm not going to quiz you on this stuff, like the specific, these things here, you don't need to study this kind of level of detail. I'm just trying to show you the big picture here. So these are like the different emission scenarios. Because when you say things like, suppose governments do nothing, how much will the globe warm by the year 2100? Well, you can't just give a number, because you got to say, well, we got to make assumptions about what China and India will do in terms of their emissions over the next century. And so they have different scenarios. And so this is showing the path of global temperature. See, these are global surface warming. That's what this y-axis is measuring. And this, of course, are the years. So you can see by the year 2100, you know, this part right here is showing, well, there is more than 4 degrees of warming, whereas this one down here is showing, oh, no, there's only like 1 degree of warming. And so what's driving that difference is the difference in emission scenarios. And there might be some other differences built into those scenarios, too. I can't remember off the top of my head what they're changing from scenario B1 to A1T to B2 and so forth. But for sure, one of the differences is the assumed rate of economic growth and the rate of decarbonization, right? So even if governments did nothing, probably in the year 2300, humans would be producing electricity not by burning coal. Just, you know what I mean? Like, it's just probably they would be doing something else by the year 2300 as a way to generate energy. So, you know, it's when you make projections about atmospheric concentrations of CO2 in the absence of government measures to penalize it, you got to make all sorts of assumptions about technological advances and so on. So you can see how speculative all this becomes. Okay. Let's give you a few important terms. So in the climate models, so there are these computer models that have the whole climate system in them. And, you know, they run for centuries, and they model to try to, you know, they're fairly sophisticated, but on the other hand, they're a far cry from the actual climate system, right? In other words, they're very crude. They're very coarse, right? That the amount of volume represented as a unit of analysis in the simulation is, off the top of my head, I don't remember how big it is, but the point is they have to have these huge cubes of the Earth's climate system, you know, in the computer simulation, because they can't go down to the molecular level, obviously. They can't keep track of all the molecules on planet Earth over 300-400 years. That would be way too much computing power, if you get what I'm saying. So anyway, they're necessarily a crude thing to try to approximate some major features of the actual climate system. So anyway, one of the key things that they're trying to estimate is what's called the equilibrium climate sensitivity. And that means that measures, after you let all the feedbacks play out, if we doubled CO2, so pre-industrial levels, like in the early 1700, it was about 280 parts per million. All right, so pre-industrial, just to give you a frame of reference, was about 280 parts per million. Incidentally, just keep that in mind. Some people don't know this. CO2 is a very small fraction of the atmosphere, right? So to double that would mean to go up to 560 parts per million. So just think about that. Even if it were 560 parts, if it were 1,000 parts per million, that would still only be 0.1%. And we're not even close to that yet. All right, I think it just recently, it's like around 400 parts per million right now. Okay, so anyway, the IPCC AR4, and again, that AR4 means the fourth assessment report, the one that came out in 2007, estimated the ECS in the range of 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius with a best estimate of 3 degrees. And so the models that the Obama administration uses to calibrate the social cost of carbon, this is one of the key things they plugged in. Oops. As a parameter to the model, you need to know from the, you know, just in terms of the physical science, by pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere, how much will the globe warm? You have to know that relationship. Otherwise, how would you have any idea of what to set the carbon tax at? If you get what I'm saying, that's one of the things you would need to understand. So the higher this parameter of the equilibrium climate sensitivity, the more damaging carbon emissions are going to be in these models, because it means a given ton of CO2 emissions is going to cause more global warming than would otherwise be the case than a lower equilibrium climate sensitivity parameter. Okay, but also just remember, this is the crucial thing after all the feedback. So we're not going to get too much into the physical science, partly because it's not my area. I mean, I'm an economist. I'm not a climate scientist. But also just because we don't have enough time. But if you do delve into this stuff, just you should know there's virtually widespread agreement on the direct impact of the greenhouse effect. In other words, there's little dispute among scientists about increasing CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. Well, now for incoming solar, you know, radiation, how much heat would be trapped now because the atmosphere has more CO2. That's pretty obvious and well understood. The issue, though, is the feedback effects that, wait a minute, now because there's a little bit more warming, you know, does that start melting the polar ice caps? And so what effect does that have? You know, and things like that, where it's not merely that you're just looking at the direct effect, but then you're trying to say if there's a positive feedback where a little bit of warming itself now sets in motion additional warming. So that means now the kick you ultimately get from emitting a little bit more CO2 is much greater depending on those feedbacks. And so that's what people are arguing about. So to get just give you a little bit more of the debate, the problem is this number of the equilibrium climate sensitivity is not borne out by the historical curve fitting. So I'm not talking about, which if you're in this area, you may know that there's this issue of, like, over the last 10 years, there's been a virtual standstill in global temperature increases. And so that's awkward for the people who are saying that carbon emissions cause really rapid global warming, because it's weird that why did this trend seem to at least pause? So, but I'm not talking about that. What I'm saying is you'll see there was not significant warming, you know, like in the 70s, for example. And the way in these models they deal with that is they say, oh, well, you know what happened is, I'm a little off. Earlier than that, there was not. So right after World War II, when, you know, atmospheric concentrations really increased and you should have seen a bunch of warming, you didn't see it, and it just doesn't quite fit. And so it seems a little bit off. And the way the models explain it is they say, oh, well, it was the, there's extra soot in the atmosphere and so forth, and that reflected a lot of the sunlight. And so it sort of masked. So, yes, the increased emissions from the post-World War II economic boom were causing CO2 concentrations to rise, but that was offset by the air pollution, which reflected the sunlight. And then after the passage of the Clean Air Act and you got rid of a lot of that air pollution, now you saw the full impact of it. And so then that's when you see that. So anyway, they have these. So what I'm saying is they have different factors that they're saying are compensating or not. So depending on a little tweak one way or the other and how you think those factors interact with each other, you can end up getting a huge range in estimates for this equilibrium climate sensitivity. So that's part of the problem, is that you don't have a laboratory experiment. In terms of laboratory reproducible experiments, where they can just, you know, tinker with CO2 and, yeah, they can come up with the number, but it's a lower number. And the point is, the people who are getting the bigger numbers, they're assuming that there's positive feedbacks, that a little bit of warming then sets in motion a chain of events that leads to more warming. And that's the thing that some of the other people don't agree with. Okay. So the economists come along, like William Nordhaus with his DICE model, these things called integrated assessment models. And this picture here, just to show you how complicated these things are, I just grabbed this off Google. So these integrated assessment models will take models of the economy for the globe and then the climate system, and they'll try to figure out, okay, so if there's economic growth and there's carbon emissions, how does that all interact? And so, these things are incredibly complicated because they're trying to keep track of not just the global economy, but also the global climate system. And then they run these things for hundreds of years, so they want to be able to say, emitting an extra ton of CO2 today, in monetized damages, what does that do between now and the next 400 years? So you can see, you know, they have to be able to answer questions like that. So they look at the marginal impact. So first they run the model, figure out climate change impacts between now and the year 2600 or whatever. Then they up front, they emit one more ton of CO2 and hold everything else equal. run the model again and then look at the differences in annual damages and then take that stream of monetary terms and discount them by some discount rate and come up with the present value figure and say that is like the social cost of carbon. And so if you were going to set an optimal carbon tax, that's the number you might use. Okay, so I just kind of spoke about the social cost of carbon. So again, let me just say it again in words. We're running low on time here. The social cost of carbon is an estimate of the monetized external damages from emitting an extra unit of CO2. So it's a Pigouvian, and you think of it as a Pigouvian framework. So again, I'm talking about the external damages. So the, you know, bestowing damages on parties who aren't part of the transaction. So you're buying a gallon of gasoline and you're driving your car around, you're putting more CO2 into the atmosphere. You're not taking into account the fact that you might be causing more people to get flooded in the year 2200 in Bangladesh. And so if we could somehow quantify the damages to those people in 2200 and then discount that back to today, because it's a future harm, and we do that for all, you know, through centuries in the future and come up with a number today, that's quantifying the external cost. And so to ensure market efficiency, to correct for that market failure, the government's going to come along and impose a carbon tax, for example, to make you aware of that externality. So now when you're buying gasoline, it's the price per gallon is higher to account for the fact that, yeah, every time you do that, you are imposing harms on people in the future. So again, it doesn't mean you would stop buying gasoline. It just means you would buy less, because before, when you weren't considering sea level rises and that kind of stuff, we were emitting more than the optimal amount of carbon. Okay, so given that framework, the social cost of carbon is heavily dependent on the discount rate. Because again, just think about it. There's possible upfront benefits of warming. I didn't say this before, but I'm saying it now. In some of these models, even one of the models chosen by the Obama administration to study this, at least for the first few decades, global warming actually produces net positive externalities. For example, it could improve agricultural output because there's more CO2 that reduces water stress in the plants and stuff like that, so they grow better. And also the changing in the distributions of the growing seasons, like in the United States, for example, when the farmers adjust and plant different crops, U.S. agricultural productivity might actually be higher for a modest range of global warming, you know, for the next few decades. And then fewer people die in the winter from extreme cold, and you know, heating bills in the winter are lower. You know, so if you think about it, it would be a coincidence if right now the Earth were at the perfectly optimal temperature, so that even a tiny little amount of warming would make us all worse off, or make us on net worse off. You see what I'm saying? Like, why would we think that? And so in some of these models, a little bit of warming actually is good. Yeah, it hurts some people, but it helps other people, and the benefits outweigh the costs. And so there's actually a net positive externality. So ironically, in that range, in a Pigouvian framework, the government ought to be subsidizing carbon dioxide emissions. But even in those models, eventually, if you warm too much, then it flips to being a net negative thing. So anyway, given that framework, that there's possible upfront benefits, but then at some point, starting like the year 2060 and going forward, it flips to net damages. Well, if you understand how discount present value accounting works, you know, you're applying a discount rate that gets bigger as the years pass. So if there's upfront benefits and then far distant costs or harms, taking the present value of that whole stream, the discount rate's really going to affect that number. And you can see, so this chart comes from the Obama administration's working group on the social cost of carbon. And you can see, you know, here's the legend that as we move from red to blue, we're increasing the discount rate. And so these are the probability distributions over the social cost of carbon. That's what the x-axis is. So you can see as we go from red to green to blue, the distributions get scrunched up toward the zero line. And in fact, look at the blue bars. These left three ones that you can see here, the tall one is at zero, and these two are actually in the negative region. And what these are measuring is the fraction of simulations. So when they ran these computer models, those left three blue bars are showing that about 25% of the simulation using a 5% discount rate popped out that the social cost of carbon was zero or even negative. All right, so that's why I was getting so frustrated with these senators who were just railing about how all the scientists agree that this is a serious problem. And I was going to say, well, it depends on the discount rate you use. At a 5% discount rate, 25% of the time, the Obama administration's own computer simulations show it's not a problem at all, or it's even a good thing that, you know, using a Pigouvian framework ought to be subsidized. So that's, don't misunderstand me. At a 5% discount rate, they still thought on net it was harmful. They thought the social cost of carbon was $12, but that's because that's the median value, right? That's the 50% value where half of the thing was this way and half of the probability mass was that way. Okay. Let's move on because we're running out of time here. So, again, how can this be that switching to a higher discount rate can make the social cost of carbon get smaller and, in fact, flip to negative, at least in certain of the models runs? Again, it's because they have early benefits and distant harms. So the three models that the working group for the Obama administration chose, this green one here, that's the fund model developed by this guy, Richard Toll. You can see that for warming up through about 2.8 or so degrees Celsius, that green line goes below the zero. So a negative, and so this is global damages. So to have negative global damages means global benefits. So that one model is showing for warming that's at least below 2.8 or so degrees Celsius, humanity benefits on net. These are external benefits. So keep that in mind too. When we're talking about benefits of CO2, we're not talking about being able to drive your car, because that's already included in the private benefit. We're just talking about external spillover benefits to people who have nothing to do with the transaction. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and eat into the Q&A time here because I don't want to continually be behind, and I won't spend too much time on the cap and trade versus a carbon tax, but I do want to run through it. And so I'm just going to eat in your Q&A time, and hopefully we'll be able to come back and still answer some of them. But okay, this issue of regulation versus market solution, just so you understand this terminology. The people will say things like, okay, we've got this externality, the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases cause climate change, global warming, and even that is a rhetorical switch. They used to call it global warming, and then they switched it to climate change. Many of us in these trenches of the policy debates think the reason they did that was because global warming hasn't really happened in the last 10 years or so. And so it was awkward for them to keep calling it global warming, so they switched to call it climate change, because now no matter what happens, you've got climate change. But anyway, one of the ways economists will talk about this is to say, rather than having direct government regulation, like to impose fuel economy standards on automobiles, to say, you know, new cars made after the year 2012 have to get at least 25 miles per gallon, you know, that kind of stuff, or to say, you know, households need to buy insulation that meets these requirements, or if you're building an apartment, you know, building, you have to have, you know, certain kind of energy efficient light bulbs installed. And so instead of having the government come in and directly micromanage energy use to try to cut back on carbon emissions, or instead of having the government give subsidies to wind turbines and and give subsidies to people doing research and development on batteries to try to make automobiles that drive on electricity rather than using gasoline, instead of doing all of those piecemeal ad hoc sort of like central planning things, just do a so-called market solution, which is typically considered to be either cap and trade or a carbon tax. So the idea is, the reason they're calling it a market solution is they're saying all you need to do is correct for the externality and then let the market work it out. So we don't want to have government officials deciding we should restrict coal-fired power plants and expand, you know, the wind turbine and so forth. That just impose the correct price on carbon, like through a carbon tax, and then market forces will determine whether coal-fired power plants should go out of business, blah, blah, blah. So you don't want the government picking winners and losers. Their only job is to fix the market failure of correcting that negative externality, and then you let the market sort it out. So that's where these people are coming from with this idea of calling them a market solution, whereas I, for example, think that that's a misnomer. That's, of course, in my mind, government intervention coming in and imposing a new carbon tax is hardly a market solution. Okay. So let me just make sure you understand this, the distinction. So a carbon tax is pretty straightforward what it means. It's just saying for every ton of CO2, for example, you have to pay a dollar amount to the government. And then the question is just, where is that levied? Is it upstream at the people who are producing crude oil, or is it at the pump? You know, it depends where you're going to collect the carbon tax. But in principle, the idea of a carbon tax is pretty straightforward. Cap and trade is a little more complicated. What it means is the government sets an annual cap on how many tons of CO2 can be emitted. And then it gives those permits to people in the private sector, or it auctions them off, and then people trade those permits. And so if you're going to emit, you know, if your firm emits 1,000 tons of CO2 in a year, you have to go in the market and buy 1,000 of those permits and then hand them over to the government. Okay, and so there are two different ways to get people to internalize the externality. So if the government had perfect knowledge about how costly it would be for industry to restrict carbon emissions, and if it had perfect knowledge about the actual external damages of carbon emissions, then the two approaches would be equivalent, right? They would just, you know, they could figure out what the optimal carbon tax was. Let's say it's $22 a ton. And they would know at $22 a ton, industry is going to restrict its emissions to the point at which, on the margin, restricting one more ton of emissions would cost more than $22. You know, so in the beginning, cutting back on emissions is cheap. You know, there's low hanging fruit. Industry could change the way it operates to start cutting back. And so, if a carbon tax is $22 a ton, they're going to do it, you know, the first few tons of emission restrictions are going to be cheap. But after a while, it gets harder and harder. You know, they run out of things to do. Like, well, what else can we do to restrict emissions? And so they keep doing things that are costlier and costlier to squeeze out further and further emission reductions. So with a given carbon tax of a certain dollar amount, industry obviously is going to respond such that they're going to restrict emissions to the point at which, on the margin, restricting additional units would be costlier than just paying the tax. So if the government had that perfect information, they would just do the same thing with cap and trade. And they could say, well, you know, at $22 a ton, we know industry would cut back and only be emitting, you know, X million tons per year. And so for cap and trade, we'll just set the cap at X million tons per year, issue that many permits or auction them off. And then we know the market price of those emissions would end up being $22 per permit. And then, you know, there'd be an equivalence. But in the real world, the government doesn't know that, have that information. And so let me just walk you through, and unfortunately I'm not going to be able to take any of your questions tonight, so I'll save them and do it in the forum. But let me, since we're on a roll here, let me gets through this because I just set it all up. All right. So the idea is, in the real world, government officials do not have perfect information about the abatement costs. So abatement means things you can do to restrict emissions. And so the curve showing the marginal abatement cost is showing how difficult is it for industry to restrict more and more in terms of emissions. And the climate change damages are actually like the benefits of restricting emissions because it's reducing climate change. So let me just walk you through this. So why might a carbon tax be better if there's uncertainty about that? So it's saying if the abatement cost curve is steeper than the climate change damage curve, you would rather put in a carbon tax rather than a cap and trade system. So let me just walk you through why that is. Okay, so this is emission reductions going this way. So the marginal benefits are declining. So I'm going to make it a very gradual marginal benefit curve. So if you think about what's the marginal benefit of more emissions reductions, it means you're sparing the planet from more climate change damage, right? For every emission, for every ton of CO2 emissions, you reduce it, you're lowering the total damages from climate change. So to have this gentle sloping curve means whether you restrict emissions by 1,000 tons or 1,001 tons or 1,002 tons, the change in total damages is pretty small. You get what I'm saying? That notice I'm not talking about the height of the marginal benefit curve. It could still be that a ton of carbon emissions reductions is very valuable, but that my point is going from 1,000 tons to 1,001 to 1,002, I'm saying the delta in the marginal benefit is shallow. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, so I'm not saying that if climate change damages on the margin are high or low, because that would just be the height of this curve one way or the other, you know, shifting the whole curve up or down. I'm talking about the steepness of the curve. Okay. And now what if the abatement costs are like this? So that's the marginal cost. So this is the marginal cost of emissions reductions. And that's a very steep curve, let's say. So that means that as you restrict more and more emissions, the marginal cost to industry of complying with that requirement rises quickly. All right. So in other words, it's not too hard to cut back emissions 10%, but whoa, if you're asking me to cut it back down 20%, now it's getting pretty pricey. And whoa, you want me to knock it down another, so like 30%, so ooh, that's, you get what I'm saying? That the screws tighten rapidly. That's what that means if there's a steep marginal cost curve from emissions reductions. So if this is the way the world works, and economists think that this is, then if you had perfect information, if the government had these curves perfectly and knew their exact shape and location, and this is dollar figures over here. So this is like tons of CO2. If you had perfect information, a carbon tax and a cap and trade would be equivalent because these curves, you know, intersect right here. So this would be the optimal price of carbon. So that would be the optimal carbon tax. And then at that level, this would be the optimal amount of reductions, this Q star. All right, so whatever that is, if it's, you know, how many thousands of tons, that would be the optimal amount. So notice, you wouldn't go down to zero. You know, the optimal emissions reduction is not 100% of current emissions. There's still going to be global warming damages, even with an optimal carbon tax. Okay, so they are thinking like economists. It's just, you know, they believe in market failure. All right, because in other words, you're going to restrict emissions so long as the marginal benefits of doing so are higher than the marginal cost. But once you pass this Q star point, the marginal cost of further emissions reductions is higher than the marginal benefit, meaning by forcing industry to figure out a different way to proceed that emits fewer tons of carbon, that's costlier than just dealing with the climate change from emitting that ton of carbon. Okay, that's the idea. Okay, so the point is, though, what now if the government's a little bit off? What if they make a mistake and they set a carbon tax that's too high? So let me just show you here. So I'll put it up right there. So what if they put, I'll put pH for, they set the price of carbon to be too high. Well, if they do the carbon tax approach, what happens is we come over here. So industry is still going to cut back to the point at which the marginal cost is equal to the new price. And that happens down here. And so you see it's just a very little increase. And there's a deadweight loss of this triangle right here. Sorry, it's a little bit hard for me to do this with this pen and so forth, but it's a little tiny triangle. And that triangle is showing you it's, you know, where this marginal cost curve is above the marginal benefit curve, and the width is how much this Q high is further to the right than the Q star was. Because again, we're assuming in the case where the government screws up, and the optimal carbon tax, let's say, should have been $25 a ton, but instead, because they have the wrong information, they set it at $27 a ton. And so if the cost curves look like we've drawn in this figure in the marginal benefit curves, it's not a big deal to be a little bit off on the carbon price. But what if they had a cap and trade system with curves that looked like this? And instead of, so you see this gap that I made here in the optimal price versus the mistaken price. What if I had the same gap over here, that here was the optimal level, and now I do the similar gap. What if now here, and so notice that's further to the right than the other Q that I drew. Now what happens? So in other words, what if they were doing a cap and trade system and they said X million tons is the optimal amount, but instead they only issue permits, for X minus 2,000 tons, right? So they didn't issue enough permits. They issued the suboptimal number of permits allowing people permission to emit those tons. What's going to happen? Well, now the price of those permits is going to be a lot higher. It's going to be up here. And you see the dead weight loss triangle is going to be bigger. It's going to include the other one. So it's going to be strictly bigger. Okay, so let me just say what I just showed you. Let me just say it in words. The idea is, if the marginal cost curve is steeper than the marginal benefit curve, making a mistake on the price is less inefficient than making a mistake on the quantity. And so that's why you would rather set a carbon tax close to what you'd make your best guess about what the social cost of carbon was and set a carbon tax, knowing that, we're probably off. We don't know exactly what the social cost of carbon is. We hope we're close. But given that we think the marginal benefits of averting climate damage is a gentler curve than the compliance cost to industry, we would rather make the mistake on the price side than make the mistake on the quantity side. Because when you make the mistake on the quantity side, if the curve looked like this, it's really damaging. Okay, last thing here, if you just give me a few more moments and I'll let you go, let me just show you the opposite case. Suppose we thought the curves look different, though. Suppose we thought that the marginal benefits of climate change damage were like this. And what might make it look like that? Well, if you thought, we really have to limit, there's a magic number, and once the atmospheric concentration of CO2 gets beyond this magic number, boom, all hell breaks loose, and ice sheets start falling, melting and falling into the ocean, and there's a runaway greenhouse effect and so forth, so that there's really a cliff in terms of if we emit too much, then all of a sudden the damages are really big. Well, then the way that would look in these curves is that the marginal benefit curve would look steeper. Okay, So, let's see. And then the marginal cost curve. Whereas, what if you thought, you know, now industry cutting back, it's not like they hit a choke point and that, yeah, they can emit, you know, they have low hanging fruit and they can cut back emissions. But then all of a sudden, oh man, it's really cut. No, what if you just thought, yeah, they have all kinds of different substitutable technologies. They could just switch to using natural gas. Then they could switch to wind turbine. It wouldn't really matter. Then you would think that there's a very gentle marginal cost curve. If that's what you thought, then it's the opposite. So again, you know, here's the P star. That's the optimal carbon price, and this is the optimal quantity of emission reductions. If you had perfect knowledge, cap and trade and carbon tax would be equivalent, because you could just hit one of the, you know, you could hit this outcome setting either P star or setting Q star. But now, what if we're uncertain? So, if you mistakenly set the quantity up here with cap and trade, so if you did a cap and trade that you were off, no big deal, because they would then, you know, restrict up to the marginal cost point, and the price would be just a little bit higher. Okay. And so you'd have this deadweight loss right there. In contrast, if they were, instead of this price, if they made a similar mistake in the price and set the carbon tax too high, I can't even, oh, duh, no wonder. I made the marginal cost curve downward sloping. No wonder I was having trouble. Sorry, everybody. The marginal cost curve ought to look like this. Maybe something was wrong. All right. Then you can see it's this huge gap. Okay. So, sorry, excuse my making the marginal cost curve downward sloping, but hope you get the idea that that's the rationale. So, again, just drawing the curves, the marginal benefit curve is going to be downward sloping, the marginal cost curve is going to be upward sloping, and the point is by altering the steepness of those curves, either the price mechanism or the quantity mechanism will be more efficient when you're uncertain. If you were certain and you knew exactly what P star was and Q star was, it wouldn't matter. But in the real world, you're not sure. And so again, in the context of climate change, the economists who study it typically think that the way these things work is that, you know, it's more important to set a price of carbon it's in the right ballpark, and then let the market sort out rather than us trying to guess the number of tons of carbon emission reductions that we ought to allow, or rather to try to guess how many tons of carbon is the optimal thing to emit next year. That economists think we're much more uncertain about, you know, the one versus the other. And so the best thing to do is just set a price of carbon that we think is close to the right number, and then we'll just see what the market does in response and what the optimal amount of emissions will be, emission reductions will be in response to that. Okay? Because they think that will cause less deadweight loss than the other. Whereas there are some who say no, and just so you realize this, there are some environmentalists who don't like a carbon tax. They would prefer cap and trade because they think that no, there, like I said, there are these tipping points, and if, you know, if atmospheric CO2 concentrations get above whatever 560 parts per million, which is twice the pre-industrial level, that then we're really in a dangerous territory, and the whole climate system might run away from us, and it might be unstoppable. And so they want to say we got to put in strict caps on emission levels. I don't care what happens to the price. Let the price be whatever it's going to be and let industry deal with it. I don't really care about that. But what I want to make sure is we don't emit too much CO2. Whereas if you put in a carbon price, you might have been wrong about the compliance cost. And maybe industry is just going to say, well, even though you've set an $80 a ton price of carbon, I'm still going to just suck it up and pay the carbon tax and keep emitting. and then you end up getting more than 580 parts per million or whatever the number is that you think is critical. So that's why some environmentalists are more concerned about, you know, setting a strict hard cap and having governments commit to a strict cap and implementing it directly rather than setting a price and hoping the price is such as to encourage people to go down to that level of emissions. Okay. Well, like I say, I'm sorry for not being able to get to any of your questions, but I wanted to make sure I cover this material. So next week, we're going to go over, now that I've given you the basic framework of the economics of climate change, we're going to go over some of the major pitfalls in this entire enterprise. All right, I will see you guys then.